Good to see y'all here this morning. And the reason I swapped the lessons around, I know this is a gospel meeting, but this, of all the four lessons, seemed more like a Bible class lesson than it did a sermon. So I figured I'd present that one at this particular time in the morning. And the idea of the four branches, I promise you we're going to get to them. It's going to take me a little bit before I get to them. It's going to start off seeming like a fundamentals of the law of Moses. We're going to look at a few things here. And I want to start off reading a story that we are all familiar with. It says in Luke chapter 2, beginning of verse 41, "Now his parents," the parents of Jesus, "went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover." Now kind of keep that in the back of your mind. "And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. And when they fulfilled the days, as they returned, the child Jesus tarried behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother knew not of it. But they, supposing him to have been in the company, went a day's journey, and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintance. And when they found him not, they turned back and again to Jerusalem, seeking him. And it came to pass that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions." Now, there's two things from this little passage I want to really say. First of all, they had went to Jerusalem for the feast. And again, we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I always wondered, you know, it seemed like Joseph and Mary were good parents. How could you not realize that after 3 days, you know, you're looking around and then Jesus is not there? Well, I heard a Jewish guide describe this story, and I'm not saying that this is how it happened, but it's the most plausible explanation I've ever heard. And from a Jewish point of view, it makes sense. When they would travel, the men would travel toward the front of the company, or the men would travel together. And then the women and the children, they would travel together. Now, they would be in one group, you know, but the men would be in front, and the women, you know, and the children be behind. Well, it says that Jesus was 12 years old. Now, when a Jewish young man gets old enough to where he can not only read from the law and can, you know, explain it, have an understanding of the law, then at that point he is considered a man. And, you know, you probably heard of a Jewish young man or a family having a bar mitzvah. It's when he becomes an adult age. And so, you know, you can imagine here now Jesus is 12 years old, and there's no doubt that his understanding was then more than probably most kids 12 years old. And so you can, in my mind, I can imagine that here Jesus is not with Mary, but she figures, well, he's traveling with the men. You know, he is of age now that he can travel and talk with them. Well, Joseph, if there was Jesus, is still just a kid. He's not the 12. He's back there with the women. And so, you know, in these two distinct groups, each thinking that he's with the other parent, you know, that makes sense to me. And then they finally, you know, we'll get together, whatever, and they say, "Was Jesus not with you?" "No, I thought he was with you." And then they turn around and go back. And whether that's true or not, at least that gives me some understanding in my mind to think that they weren't just neglectful and then that they were sublime, that they didn't notice for 3 days that Jesus wasn't walking between them, because probably they weren't, you know, walking together in the same group anyway. Well, anyway, it says that they were going to Jerusalem again for the feast. And the law of Moses was very, very specific. And you know, that's one thing you read about the Bible, that the Bible is not a book of generalities. God gives instructions, and he expects those instructions to be carried out. He doesn't just give them to be giving out instructions. That in Leviticus chapter 23, beginning in verse 4, it talks about the first feast. And we're going to talk about these feasts for just a moment, and then we're going to scoot right home. But it says, "These are the feasts of the Lord, even holy convocations, which ye shall proclaim in their seasons." And that's important too. "In the 14th day of the first month at even is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of the unleavened bread unto the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread." And we all think about why it was called the Passover. Remember, the children of Israel were down in Egypt, and the 9 plagues had an effect on Pharaoh and on his people. They said, well, this has got to be the finger of God. And, you know, at times Moses has relented and felt bad, and, you know, but then his heart would be hardened, and he wouldn't let him go. And so finally this worst plague was going to come, the death of the firstborn, from the richest to the poorest, from the famous to the infamous, whatever. And remember, God gave him instructions. He said, take a lamb, and when you kill it, take the blood, and put it over, we might say, you know, the trim, the door trim, the lintel around the door, and I'm going to send my angel throughout the country. And when the angel sees that blood, it will pass over, and you will be saved. And you might well be spared anyway, saved, same difference. You might think, well, what actually saved the firstborn of the Israelites? The blood literally did not save them. No, but it was their obedience to what God had told them. You know, and God saved them. You know, everybody else, their firstborn are dying, but when God saw that they believed Him and they did what He said, then the death angel or the destroyer went on, and thus they're saved by God through their obedience. But anyway, that is something that the Jews would remember. And he said, you're going to keep this feast for as long as there's a Jewish nation, we're going to celebrate the Passover because of this wonderful thing, God's deliverance, and how you were saved when many perished. Now, in the New Testament, we read that even though it's been, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later, obviously the Jews are still very conscientiously taking care of their business and doing this feast or observing this feast. It's a holy convocation. And without belating the point, just one verse, it said, now the first day of the feast of the unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying unto him, where wilt thou that we prepare for thee to eat the Passover? And so it was that time of the year, and they're ready to eat the Passover. Well, it also says in Leviticus 23, verses 15 and 16, and he shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete, even to the morrow of the 7th Sabbath, after you number 50 days, and you shall offer a new meat offering unto the Lord. Well, basically what it was saying was 50 days after this, you're going to celebrate another feast, and it's going to be called Pentecost. The 50, you know, 50 days, 7 weeks and a day. And it really, it came about as this was the time when their gardens first started coming in, or their crops first started coming in, because it's also called the feast of the, you know, the first fruits. You know, by now they've planted and they're starting to have some results of that, and so they call it Pentecost. It's also the first feast of the first fruits. And we might think about immediately in Acts chapter 2 how the apostles were gathered together in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost and the great events that transpired that day. But much after that, you know, many years later, Paul is preaching the gospel. Paul is a Christian. He's no longer a Jew. They're no longer Jews and Gentiles. Paul is simply a Christian. But look what it says in Acts chapter 20 and verse 16. For Paul had determined to sail by Ephesus, because he would not spend the time in Asia, for he hasted, if it were possible for him, to be at Jerusalem the day of Pentecost, not to celebrate it as a Jew, but because he knew there were going to be a lot of religious people there, people that cared about God, people that needed to hear the gospel. And so he was going to hurry anyway at all, he could get there in time for Pentecost. But there we see, you know, obviously it's still being celebrated by the Jews. And then you look in Leviticus 23 and verse 34, and it says, speak unto the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of the 7th month shall be the feast of tabernacles for 7 days unto the Lord. And this is a real interesting feast because, you know, each feast represented something. They would build them little, what we call brush arbors, or little tents or whatever, out of branches and whatever they could get. And according to the Jewish teachings, it had to be open enough for at night they could see the stars and the moon through the cracks in it. And if it rained, they would get wet. You know, they don't get tarpaulins and fix it up, or, you know, be so warm and, you know, careful there that nothing could get to them, because it would remind them of the times that they traveled in the wilderness. And but it was also called the Feast of the Ingathering. You know, we had the Feast of the First Fruit. This is the Feast of the Ingathering. And now their crops are playing out. The gardens are about to run out. You know, all their crops are done. And so they're gathering in the last of their crops. And so it's called the Feast of Tabernacles, but also the Feast of the Ingathering. And we can see this in the life of Jesus. In John chapter 7, verse 2, it says, now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. Well, Jesus didn't go right ahead. He sent his disciples on ahead. And so when they got there, they started asking, well, where is Jesus? They said, the Jews saw him at the feast, and they said, well, where is he? Well, he wasn't there. He didn't come with them. But we know that later on he did arrive, and he began to teach them. Now, in the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple, and he taught them. And so you get to thinking about them, and I always like to put them in perspective to our month. You know, we can talk about the month of Abib and Nisan and all those type of things, but when you think about it, the Passover was roughly, we might say, in the middle of April. You know, we celebrate Easter as a, you know, collectively as a nation. You know, we don't celebrate it as a congregation of the Lord's people. But the Passover was, you can think, was last month. And then Pentecost would have been in June, you know. And then when we think about the Feast of the Tabernacles or the Ingathering, that would have been about October. So we're kind of in between two of the feasts. But that, you know, kind of get it in your mind what they would have looked like. But there was actually a couple of other feasts that the Jews recognized and participated in. And one of them was the Feast of Purim. It says, and that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city. And that from these days the Purim should not fail from among the Jews, nor the memorial of them perish from their seed. Now this is not something that was given at Mount Sinai, you know, by the law that was delivered to Moses. But remember the story of Mordecai and Esther and Haman, and how that the Jews were in danger of being completely eradicated. And because of the bravery of Mordecai and Esther, she risked her life to go plead before the king for her people. And we know that not only were they spared, but they were allowed to take their vengeance on their enemies, and many of their enemies were destroyed. And it was a great victory for the Jews and a great day of celebration, so they would remember that one. And then there was also a feast that was called the Feast of Dedication, or the Feast of Lights. And Jews today call it Hanukkah. And let me tell you how ignorant I am, or I was. But now I'm just ignorant about other things. But back then, when I was a child, I always thought Hanukkah was just how the Jews celebrated Christmas. Now, how far off could you be from that? You know, them Jews celebrating about the birth of Christ. Well, I didn't know. You know, about the same time everybody else was putting up their Christmas trees, and the Jews were celebrating Hanukkah. But though it is in Jerusalem, it was really the rededication of the temple. And we won't go into all that. But I do want to show you a picture here. I, again, always thought that, you know, over there in the Middle East, that it's always hot and dry, you know, and maybe the weather's always nice. But let me tell you, in Jerusalem, in December, it's cold. You know, their weather's about like ours. They get snow. And, you know, Jerusalem is up in the hills, and so that would add to it. But here's a picture of the Church of All Nations. But behind it, that's the Mount of Olives. And if you notice, the snow covers the ground. And so it's cold in December in Jerusalem, or it can be. You know, like here, sometimes we have mild winter, sometimes we have pretty rough winter. But with that in mind, you think about, it says Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. And so he's walking around. Why is he walking? Well, you know, in my mind, I can just imagine, you know, here it's that time of the year, and he's walking to keep warm. You know, he's standing there, and it's snow outside and everything. Well, he's walking around, and he's talking and preaching or teaching, however you want to look at it. But this was a feast that Jesus recognized as a Jew, because Jesus was a Jew, and they celebrated that. This right here, again, I love pictures to help me visualize what things would have looked like. Now, obviously, the temple is not there in Jerusalem. If you were to visit Jerusalem, the Muslims have control of the Temple Mount. And I don't mean to get sidetracked, but now if there's ever a crazy country, it's Jerusalem, or the city of Jerusalem and the country of Israel. The Muslims have control of the Temple Mount. But there's Christians in Jerusalem, there's Muslims in Jerusalem, and obviously there's Jews in Jerusalem. And then throughout the country, you might go up. If you want to go up to see Jacob's Well, it's under control of the Palestinian Authority. And even though it's right there in the middle of Israel, the Muslims have control of it. If you want to go to Bethlehem, you go through a military checkpoint with barbed wire and concrete walls. They wouldn't allow a Jewish guide to go through. You know, and then you go through, and you look at everything, and come back out, City of Jericho is under the Palestinian Authority. And so it really mixed up. So anyway, this is a representation of what the temple would look like. They've actually got a model city over there. It's built to scale, and it's the big, you know, you walk around it, and it shows what Jerusalem would have looked like in the time of Jesus. But this is the southern gate. And if you'll notice, right here, they have these steps leading up through here. But now that's like down in the basement. And so actually, inside the temple area itself, you would come up through the tunnel. And so, you know, the gates or the steps are way down low. You come up through here, and then you would come into the temple area, and then where those posts are, it's a big covered area, and it goes all the way around. But that was Solomon's porch. And so it's a good place to study or to meet together or come to pray or whatever. And then you look at the temple area here, and you're thinking, well, that just don't look that very big. But you say the Temple Mount was huge. I want to say 35 or 36 acres. Now, it's huge up there. I mean, it's a long way. So thousands and thousands and thousands of people would have had room to be up there. And here's another picture of it from the western side. And you can start seeing right here is the Antonio Fortress. And we're going to talk about that maybe a little bit later on. But you think about the temple. And when the Jews still had a temple, they would come into the temple area to worship. Well, you know what happened in AD 70? The Romans finally had enough of the Jews, and one thing led to another, and the temple is destroyed, it's burnt, and it's cast down, and the Temple Mount is just leveled. And so the Jews today, they want to still worship under the law of Moses, because that's what they believe in, but they can't go up on the Temple Mount. But again, the Muslims have control of it. So they go to the Western Wall, which is, you know, back here on the back side. And it's still standing. It was like a foundation wall. It wasn't the wall of the temple, but if you kind of think about it, the land sloped like this when David was there. And so they built walls like this on this side and this side and this side. and made a level spot. And then the temple was actually up on top of that. Well, see, this western wall is just one of those foundation walls. We've all built foundation walls or seen them. Well, that's the closest thing that the Jews have. So they go to the western wall, which is close to the most holy place that they could get, and it's there that they pray. Now, we've talked about a lot of things so far, and we're to the point now that the lesson's fixing to really make sense about the four branches. The Jews have a ritual that when they go to pray during, you know, these feasts and things, that they have a very particular prayer or certain prayers to pray. And what they do, they take four branches and they bind them together. And they hold these four branches and then they say these prayers. And to the Jews, these four branches represent all the people of the world. And I got to looking at that, and to me it really makes sense. And that's what we're going to be talking about this morning. The branches that they take, again, are specific. You don't just go out to the first tree that you come to and lop four branches off. It's not, the significance is not in the number four, in four branches. And that'll make a little bit more sense because they take a citrus branch, and, you know, we might think of a lime tree or a lemon tree or an orange tree. And I always remember as a child, we would sometimes go to Florida, and back when they still had orange groves right on the side of the road, and when you got close to them, you'd start smelling them orange trees, and boy, they always smelled so good, you know. But they would take a citrus branch, because it had smell, you know, you could smell it, and it was a very pleasant smell. It also had taste. Whatever citrus tree you had some kind of fruit on it. So it had smell and taste, okay? They would take a palm branch, and when we think of a palm tree, I always think of some tropical island, you know, that had coconuts in it, but for them, it would be a palm fig tree. And we know figs were very important back then. You remember the story of David when he was kind of on the run and he was protecting this particular man's flock by night, and he sent to see if they would help him out. And the old Nabal, he was, you know, a curly man, and he wouldn't help him at all. But his wife got fig cakes and raisins and sent to him. But figs were a very important part of their diet back then. But the palm tree, it has figs, so it does provide taste. You know, there's something to eat, but you smell of it, and there's no smell to it. It doesn't smell good or anything. It just provides something that you could eat. They also take a branch of a myrtle tree, and we think maybe a crepe myrtle. So I have several at my house. When the Japanese beetles don't eat all the buds up, it buds out, and it's real pretty. But a myrtle branch has a wonderful smell. You know, in the summer, when spring, it starts blooming. Mind you, it starts blooming about the 1st of June or the middle of June. Smells so good, but there's no fruit on it. You know, you can go to it and you can smell it and enjoy the smell, but it has nothing to eat. So there's no taste. And then they also take a willow branch. And I don't know if y'all ever had a weeping willow tree. I had one, and the bigger it got, the more fragile it got. It didn't break off. And I finally cut that thing down. But obviously a willow tree doesn't have any fruit on it, and it doesn't smell good. So, you know, it's nothing to eat. But they take each one of these four branches. This one has neither smell nor taste. Now here, just so you'll know, I'm not just making all this up. Here's a picture of a Jewish feast. It's taken, you know, probably in the past 10 years. And they're before the wailing wall. And if you'll notice, they got the four branches together. In fact, I think you can see maybe, you know, a little bit of the fruit there in his hand. But they bound them together, and they get to the wailing wall. And then they say their prayers, and they're praying for all the people of the earth. And they're all represented by those four branches. What we're going to do for what time we have left this morning is to talk about these four different kinds of people. And then I want to think very honestly about ourselves and the Bible. You know, which one of those branches represents me? Because we're in there somewhere. I guarantee you that we're all represented by one of these branches. We talked about last night of looking into the perfect law of liberty, like looking into a mirror and trying to figure out what we look like. Well, that's the kind of way this lesson is. We think about these things and we see where we are, and if it's not where we want to be, then maybe we need to make some changes in our life. But anyway, getting back to it, let's talk about the palm branch first. It has taste, but it has no smell. You know, again, the fig tree. We can look at this, and here is the city of Capernaum, and that's that synagogue. But if you'll notice, these are palm trees, but they're also fig trees. Here's a little closer up, and you can see they get loaded with figs. And I was preaching this lesson over at West Hamilton, where Bob used to preach many years ago. And, you know, I said, now this is something that we can't really relate to. And we got through, and half the people there said, well, I got fig trees at my house. Eugene had fig trees. Daryl had fig trees. Lee had fig trees. And so they all had, might not look like this, but they had figs that were growing there at their house, and Lee's talking about eating them for breakfast and things like that. But anyway, here's a tree that has a lot of fruit, and again, taste but no smell. Well, to the Jews, this represents people that have zeal, very zealous, but they have no knowledge of the Bible. And I assure you that there are many people in the world like this today. Zeal, just by itself, is neutral. Zeal can be good, or it can be bad. It just depends on the way it's directed. Look in Colossians chapter 4, verses 12 and 13. It says, Epaphras, who is one of you, a servant of Christ, saluteth you, always laboring fervently for you in prayers, that you may stand perfect and complete in all the will of God. For I bear him record that he hath a great zeal for you, and them that are at Laodicea and Hierapolis. And so here was a man who was zealous, but in a very positive way. He had a great zeal for the people that he was worshiping with. But then you look at somebody like Paul, or Saul of Tarsus, maybe as he was known back then. He said, you want to talk about zeal? I persecuted the church, and I was zealous at it. I mean, I was hard on them. I committed them to prison, and I was there, and I gave my voice against them. And then he talked about touching the righteousness which is in the law of Moses, blameless. But then he began to talk about the Jews in the time that he lived. Later on, not talking about his life, but talking about the Jews. He said, I bear them record that they have a zeal of God. And so, that in itself is good. They're zealous toward God. But then he said, but not according to knowledge. And, I find it interesting that the Jews would use this phrase to represent people that would have zeal and no knowledge, thinking of other people and not themselves. But Paul, that's the very way that he described the Jews. Very zealous. But they don't understand. They have no knowledge. In fact, in his first verse, we see that he wasn't saying this to be critical or just, running them down. He loved them people. He grew up as a Jew. This was his brethren, his friends, his neighbors. Brethren, he said, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved, and they have zeal, but not according to knowledge. And then in verse 3, he explains a little bit more about this zeal and lack of knowledge. He said, for they being ignorant of God's righteousness and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. And so, we have to be very, very careful today that we submit ourselves to the righteousness of God. In other words, we try to live the way that God would have us to live it. We don't go back to set up our own rules and regulations and ways of the way that we think it should be done and the ways that we think would please God when God has told us how to please Him. That's the situation that the Jews were in, and even though they didn't recognize it. In a very, very practical sense, we see this today, and there are religious groups that, as far as zeal goes, would put us to shame, or put me to shame. I can't speak for y'all, but I tell you, my day off is on Thursday. Well, one Thursday morning, I got up, I put on my old grungy blue jeans and an old t-shirt because I was fixing to go out and cut grass. And I live on a dead-end road. There's me and another house and another house and another four houses, and it's like a dead-end road. So anybody that comes down that road is either coming to see one of the four of us or they make the wrong turn, because there ain't no other choice. There ain't no going through. So I'm just going out the door, and this car pulls up, and there's three ladies in there. Well, I don't recognize them, so I'm thinking, well, what in the world do they want? And they get out, and one lady was the spokesman, and she said, have you got time to talk about something really important? And I said, well, if it's important, I got time to talk about it. And she said, imagine this. How would you like to live someday on an earth where there's no pain, there's no suffering, there's no problems, there's no dying, and you can live forever on an earth like that that's just a paradise? And I said, well, I'll just be honest with you. I said, that just don't feel to me. I said, I want something better than that. I said, when I die, I want to go to heaven. I want to be there and see the throne of God, and I want to hear the angels, and I want to sing with them, and I want to walk the streets of gold. We talked for about 30 seconds, and that woman looked at me, and she said, you're a member of the Church of Christ, aren't you? And that impressed me so much, because I didn't tell her that I even went to church or where I went to church, but after we talked for just a minute, we talked for another minute or so, and I knew I wasn't going to change them. They knew they wasn't going to change me, and so they thanked me for my time, and then they left. But here they were, on Thursday, I'm going to be cutting grass, and they're out teaching what they believe. Now, whether I agreed with it or not, that's not the point, but they were zealous. They were out there trying to teach what they honestly believed, what they believed. And, in the little town I live in, Hayville, it's not an uncommon sight to see two young men on bicycles riding along, they're mowing. And they're out going from door to door asking anybody that would give them the time to sit down and study with them and let them teach what they would have to teach. And I wonder how much time we spend in doing that. Now, as Christians, oftentimes we're good defenders of the truth. When the Jehovah's Witnesses came to talk to me, I defended what I believed in, and I believe I was zealous in defending it, and I believe I was trying to teach them the truth. But sometimes that's as far as we go. When somebody, you know, questions us or attacks us, then we will stand up, and we will teach, and we will fight back. And I say that in a kind word. But, you know, do we have the zeal to go on the offensive? You know, when we're on the defensive, when we're defending what we believe, we're good at that. But how often are we out there trying to teach other people the gospel? There's a lot of people out there that have a great zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. In Acts chapter 6 and verse 10, it says, speaking of Stephen, and they were not able to resist the wisdom and the spirit by which he spake. And, you know, that again, that might describe us when one questions what we believe in. But we've got to be able to take the gospel to others. The result, what is the result? If you have zeal and you don't have knowledge, you know, you don't really study the Bible, and you don't really, you depend on more what you feel in your heart than what you read in the Bible. Well, it tells us in 2 Peter 3 and verse 16, as also in his epistles, speaking in them of things in which some things are hard to be understood. And this is Peter writing about Paul. He said, which they that are unlearned and unstable rest, as they do also the other scriptures, not just the hard ones, but the other scriptures, unto their own destruction. And so here's a person that's full of zeal, but they don't have knowledge. And so they twist the scriptures, and in so doing, they twist them to their own destruction. Now, I realize that everybody starts off as a babe in Christ. You know, we obviously don't know everything about the gospel when we become a Christian, and we never get to the point where we know everything. Every time I visit Bob, we start talking about things, and he teaches me things that I've never thought of before. But, you know, we grow in knowledge, but the idea is we've got to grow in knowledge. You know, we can't just depend upon zeal and nothing else. Sometimes you might think, well, man, like Apollos, he taught what he believed and what he understood, but he wasn't complete in his understanding, and that's taken to the side and teaching more perfectly the way of the Lord. And then he began to teach that. And so he was zealous, but he didn't have a full understanding, but he had a right attitude. And when somebody tried to teach him, then he believed it, and he went on from there. Well, we've got to shoot on. Bob was wondering if I could make it till 15 after, and it's 5 after nearly, and I've only got through the first break, so I'm going to have to speed it up a little bit. But here, 10:30, do what now?
You go 10:30.
I don't want to do that much to you. I don't want you to be like the lady you just talked about. But again, to summarize this, zeal by itself is not enough. Matthew 7, verse 21, not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven. Here's the one that recognizes the Lord, so to speak, has a zeal for him. But he that doeth the will of my Father, which is in heaven. And then you look in verse 22, and we see a manifestation of their zeal. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? In thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works. These were active people that Jesus is talking about. These are not people just sitting in their house. They're out doing things. But remember, he said he wasn't pleased with them. It's those that did the will of the Father. Well, let's get to the myrtle branch. This is the branch that has smell, but has no taste. And to the Jews, this represented people that have knowledge, but they have no zeal. Now see, this is right the opposite of the one that we just looked at. And I'm afraid this describes me as Christians. You know, we study the Bible. We come to Bible class. We read our Bibles. We know the Bible, but do we teach the Bible? Do we have the zeal that these other groups have? We might think that we have a great understanding of the Bible, but are we willing to share it? But we know we need to be teaching it. And James said, therefore to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. In James chapter 1, verse 25, remember we talked about looking into the perfect law of liberty, but he said that the doer of the work, this man should be blessed in his deed. Not the one that hears and forgets, but the one that actually doing the work. And we might think, well, what is the work? And very, very quickly, think about some people in the time of Jesus. That they saw Jesus, they heard Jesus, and they believed on Jesus. And we think, well, that's a wonderful thing. You know, they believed in Jesus. But it tells us also that for whatever reason, and it does tell us a reason, they didn't have the zeal or desire to act upon their faith and their belief. And maybe faith is not the right word. Maybe the fact that they just believed, but it says they believed on him. But the passage says, nevertheless, among the chief rulers also many believed on him. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. They loved the praise of men more than they did the praise of God. But you know what a sad story. Here's people that believed, and it says they believed on him, but they were afraid to confess him because of the peer pressure, we might say. And we would think, well, how crazy could you be to believe and not be willing to go on with it? We would certainly never be like that. Well, in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 2, it says, "And the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also." Now, that's just a very, very simple command. But what you've heard and you believe, you need to teach other faithful men or other faithful Christians, and they'll be able to teach others also. But why do we not get out and do that? You know, we've got to apply the knowledge that we have. Is it because we're afraid? Is it because of peer pressure that we don't teach the gospel to others? Let me tell you, it's a much easier thing, and I'm not saying that I do it well, but I'm just saying as far as from an emotional point of view or whatever, to stand up here in the midst of brethren, people that love God, and to proclaim the truth, that's easy. But I wonder in my life, how many people have I had conversations with, how many people have passed through my life that were lost, and I never said a word to them without Jesus. You know, I never invited them to church, I never invited them to read the Bible. The number would be quite a few, and I'm sure it's the same for all of us. But why? You know, we know, and so we say, well, there were people that believed, and they wouldn't act on it. Well, we believe, and it says to teach, and to teach other people that they might be able to teach. You know, it's just like a pyramid. The more you teach, and each person begins to teach, and it grows exponentially. Why do we not do it? I guess we have to all look in our own hearts to find the answer to that question. But there's a song. I didn't look if it's in the blue book or the red book or either or both, but we all know it. It says, "When in the better land before the bar we stand, how deeply grieved our souls may be. If any lost one there should cry in deep despair, you never mentioned him to me." And if it's possible that we can talk to those in line with us, this might be a sentiment. Because if you never mentioned him to me, you helped me not the light to see, you met me day by day and knew I was afraid, yet never mentioned him to me. And again, I'm afraid that that's really going to apply to a lot of us. Hope it doesn't. Maybe it's just me. But that's something we need to consider. Moving right along, we get to the willow branch. And this one has neither smell nor taste. And so I'm sure you've gotten ahead of me now. You can apply what that means. That's the person that doesn't have any zeal and he doesn't have any knowledge. Well, what kind of person is that? Well, that's the person that don't know and he don't care. He don't want to know. There's always been people like that when it comes to religious matters. And in Psalms 1 verse 6, "The Lord knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish." And so here are people, you know, they don't care about God. They don't know about God. They don't want to know about God. And, you know, they said that these people are going to perish when their lives are over. Psalms 14 verse 1, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They've done abominable work. There is none that doeth good, but there is no God." You look at the attitude of the world that we live in, and I'm not just talking about these communist countries and things like that. Even in America, people scoff at the idea of God. And then, you know, you can even be ridiculed for expressing a belief in God or trusting in the Bible. In Romans chapter 1, verse 18, it says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness." And you look down in verse 23, and I can just imagine this was written yesterday. Because of the country and the direction we're headed. "Who, knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them." And so they know it's wrong, they don't care. You know, they won't admit it's wrong. But then they take pleasure in everybody else is doing it. They're doing it themselves. Like they don't know, and they don't want to know, they don't care. This is a very sobering verse too, because you know, someday or sometime in our life this could have been us. And I'm not talking about in a broad sense like it's talking here, but there was a time probably in all of our lives when we weren't Christians. Maybe we were at the age of accountability, but we weren't Christians. And to make, you know, an individual application to that, at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise. But being without Christ means having no hope and without God in the world. What a terrible thought to walk this time we have upon this earth without Christ and thus having no hope. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 3, "But if our gospel be hid, it is hid to them that are lost." And again, what a terrible, terrible word that is. It's not like lost in Macon. You know, I'm trying to find this and I take the wrong street and I can't find the building here. I'm halfway lost and it's not talking about being on an island or a TV show and things like this. When it's talking about being lost, it means being lost for an eternity when life is over. And so many times it's sad because those that are lost, when it's hid to those that are lost, it's our family. It's our friends, it's our neighbors, you know, the people that we know so well, people that we love, are lost.
because they don't know the Bible. They're not concerned about the Bible, and we've got to try to figure out some way to stir them up and get them interested. We've got to have zeal. We've got to have knowledge to do that.
Anyway, getting right along, in 2 Thessalonians 1, verse 8, our last point on this, it says that when the day of judgment comes, that he's going to take vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. If they have no knowledge and they haven't acted, they're going to be lost. And that's not me. It's not a condemnation, because I don't want that to happen. I'm like Paul with the Jews. We're all like that. We don't want anybody in the world to be lost. But it's going to happen because they don't know and they don't act. Well, finally, we get to the last branch, and again, you know what this one is. The citrus branch has both smell and taste, and so this is the person that has both knowledge and zeal. This is the type of person that God is looking for. John chapter 4 and verse 24, because we can probably all quote that verse. We know what it says, but do we really know what it means? God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. And I've heard different explanations for this, but it all boils down to, if we've got to know God, and then we've got to worship him with all we have, with all our soul, with all our mind, with all our might, with all our strength. You know, we've got to love God above everything else, and then love our neighbors, ourselves. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 16, here we see the concept of knowledge and a desire to put that knowledge to work, to teach others. Take heed unto thyself and unto the doctrine. Continue in them. For in so doing, I will both save thyself. You study the Word and you continue. You be faithful in it and you can save yourself. And it's by, again, by the grace and mercy of God and by obedience. But anyway, he said, you stay in it. So he said, not only will your soul be saved when all is done, but those that hear you. And so a dependence upon the gospel and teaching others, those that hear you can be saved also. In Revelation 1 and verse 3, it said, blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand. Now, when a person reads and he hears, he acquires knowledge. But then it says, he that keeps those things, that shows us that action is being taken. That they're doing something with what they hear, what they've read, and what they have believed. Again, a very familiar passage in 2 Timothy 3, verses 16 and 17. That all Scripture is given by the inspiration of God and profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, the man of God may be perfect or complete, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. And basically what he's saying, that we may know and that we may act. We have the gospel. We have the Bible. We have everything that we need. It's sufficient for all of our needs. And so we're furnished for all good works. We've got to get out there and teach it to others. We've got to have the knowledge. We've got to have the zeal. That's the type of people that are pleasing unto God. As we've read even in an earlier lesson, but not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. We've got to get out and we've got to teach what we have understood and what we have studied. Now Jesus said the same thing in Matthew chapter 7, verse 24. Therefore, whosoever heareth these things of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which built his house upon a rock. And you remember how the rain came, the waters rose up, but this house wasn't washed away because it had a strong foundation. But again, look what he's saying. Whoever hears my words and then puts them into action in his life, whoever lives by them, that's a wise man. Because he's not going to be destroyed. And then he went on to talk about the man that heard and didn't put him into action, and we know what happened after that. Well, what's going to happen? How easily, you know, we are distracted. How many people are going to fit in this category? Well, it's as straight as the gate and narrow as the way which leads unto life, and few there be that find it. Those that are going to sincerely listen to God and then they're going to act upon whatever, because there's going to be few that find it. And that's not the way that God wants it. You remember we were talking about the lesson on confidence? God doesn't want anybody to be lost. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Jesus died on the cross. He's long-suffering, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the reality of it is that it's difficult and it's narrow. And there's going to be few that find it. Now, this chart right here, it's just something I've made up. There's no mathematical basis for it. There's no biblical basis for it. It's just in my own mind. I try to imagine, you know, how does the world pan out? You look at that area that's in the green, and I put that to neither. That's people that they don't know, they don't care. And then this people right here, you know, are zealous people. All the religious people of the world that are worshiping God, but not according to the simplicity of the Scriptures. You know, there's a lot of those too. You see a group of people here maybe that have knowledge and no zeal. But you see the smallest one of all is those that have both. And again, the whole point of this lesson is to get us to realize, you know, different conditions a person could be in, and to ask ourselves, where do I fit in? And I'm afraid that so many times, well, we know where we fit in. You think about the parable of the sower, and I know our time is very quickly running out. Some seed fell by the wayside, and the birds came and gobbled it up, and before they had a chance to really think in their heart and make a change in their life. That's not me. Some seed fell upon stony ground or rocky ground, and the wet sprang right up, but then the sun came out and it didn't have any root, and when persecution came or ridicule, whatever, then the plant just wilted and fell away. Well, that's not me. I'm here. I'm faithful. And then some seed fell upon the thorny ground. And you remember it sprang up, and the thorns sprang up around it, and it choked it all, and it didn't produce any fruit. You know, if it's tomato plants, there wasn't no tomatoes on them or whatever in the parable part of it. Well, you know, I just don't really sense around me, but then it said some fell upon the good ground and it sprang up and it produced fruit, some 30-fold, some 60-fold, some 100-fold. Well, that's us, isn't it? Well, I don't know, is it? You look at those last two, there's a plant that hadn't died. It's alive. You know, it continues to live just like the plant in the good soil, but the fruit is in the fruit. You'll know a tree by its fruit. Well, this plant has no fruit. Well, we know that if it's on the good soil, that's going to produce some fruit. And I'm not just saying that we count the number of people that we converted or brought to church. If that's the only thing that there is involved with it, it's, you know, that would be a whole other lesson or series of lessons and what we should do. But the whole point is, again, we need to honestly examine ourselves and think, are we the good soil? Are we producing for the Lord? Or are we simply alive? You know, the plan has not died. We haven't given up. We haven't forsaken the assembly. We still come to church when the door is open. But are we doing any more than that? You know, is our knowledge being supplemented with zeal? And are we trying to be good examples like we talked about last night in the jury? Are we trying to teach others? Are we trying to help those that are down and out and lift up the hands that are fallen and do all those things that we read about in the Bible? Well, again, that's something that each and every one of us has to judge for themselves. Well, the few said the four branches represented all the people in the world, and I believe that's true. And so we need to reflect upon our own life and see which branch we are. If we're not happy with it, then we need to make the changes. Thank you so much. Y'all let me just talk and listen very, very kindly, and I appreciate that so much. I don't know how you end the class, but that's how I end.